Thursday, August 17th, 2017. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Pope Runyon. And tonight we're honored to present a review and discussion on the new book of magical fiction, Stories of Magic and Enchantment by William Mistely, with the author as our guest. Now, this book is handsomely published by Falcon Books, a new publisher in the field. As regular listeners will recall, we have supported Bill Mistely from the beginning of his writing and publishing career, having had him on as a guest with his first book, Undines, in 2010, and this was followed by Mermaids, Sylphs, Gnomes, and Salamanders in 2012. And as you might suppose, Bill is very much into Franz Barden's Hermetic Elemental Personifications. He writes from a deep empathy for sacred nature and its spirits, encountering them in human form as magicians often do. He favors the feminine spiritual perspective. His stories are remarkably free from the usual horror and conflict we associate with supernatural fiction. We might say they are totally opposite to H.P. Lovecraft, while being lovingly crafted. Bill has a degree in philosophy and has spent years studying and meditating with Buddhist and Taoist and Native American teachers. He finally devoted himself to the Bardonian system of magic and has more books in the works. So, if you would like to meet a true magical maestro and learn about his visionary work, stay with us and be enchanted. And, Maestro, are you with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. I can hear you. Yeah, I can read you 5x5. So stay on. Now, what I would like to do is kind of go through the table of contents on the book here, but first I'd like you to talk about your background that I just summarized, and I summarized it from what you have in the back of the book here. Tell us, in your own words, how you all this anthropological field work that you did with these various traditions, how that finally guided you to Franz Barden. I would like to know that. So would you go ahead and tell us about that?
Yeah, well, I think part of it comes from my family of origin. My parents went to a huge extent to socialize me so that I would grow up to be normal. But these were complete extroverts. And they had me in all sorts of social organizations and religious organizations. But it was back in the 60s, it was a time of great conflict, and we had a lot of political things going on in the world. But mainly, I was captivated in a kind of a visceral level with the fact that, while Bill Gates and Warren Buffett were going out building their $50 billion empires, I was acutely aware that every day the whole world could be vaporized and come to an end within a few hours with an all-out nuclear exchange. And in the 60s, a lot of people, majority of people, believed there would be such a war. So in that context, when I looked at all these religious traditions and philosophical and wisdom and institutions surrounding me, which were, offering me all sorts of paths to success, it dawned on me that, what is the value of success if the whole scheme of society is so contingent on accident? And there were at least six times when the world was minutes away from an all-out nuclear conflict. So that got me in a mythological vein, like, why are we here? What is our purpose? What are human beings supposed to accomplish, And those are real questions for me, not as a traditional question, but as, very, very much now, right now in my life, how am I supposed to direct myself in a meaningful way in this context? So after college, I began studying esoteric oral traditions because I wanted an environment where language wasn't literal, I came out of this 500 years. Read the Bible, literal. And it seemed they were missing the drama of the inner self and the discovery process of what it is to become a spiritual being. So I turned to the old traditions on earth. The Hopi Indians had the 900-year-old settlement, the longest existing city in the United States. The Nyingma tradition in Tibetan was founded by Padmasambhava back in the 9th century. The Taoist lady I studied with had a monastery that existed for 2,000 years in China, had never been torn down or invaded. These were some of the people I went to where I could listen to how they worked the inner world of the self with the outer world. They were in at this time. So that got me going, and it prepped me. I was already had an immense capacity of clairsentience before I picked up the first book of Bardens. So I was already like kind of fully engaged. So the Bardens approach gave me like, you know, a path. You know, he's saying like, here's the four elemental kingdoms. Enter them, make them like a second home, and embody the wisdom and perceptions of those realms. This is an immense, but, you know, being clairsentient, it was like, oh, here's a mermaid queen. Oh, here's a king of the salamanders. It was like really simple. It was as easy to read their auras, the auras of someone sitting next to me. So that got me going. But this type of superficial read the aura and you think you understand is not the same as you know, realizing that these races have different evolutions and then they're not talking to each other. And the human race itself has many different ways of going, and these different ways are not talking to each other either. So that put me in perspective of, you know, why am I here? And I look at myself not as a spiritual person, but as someone to solve problems. That was my family tradition. You have a problem, you solve it. People don't know how to do a stick shift engine, you invent the automatic transmission, which my uncle did for General Motors. You know, you don't have TV or radio. What do? You go down to Kitty Hawk and you watch the Wright brothers testing their new plane, which my uncle and my mother did. You know, so it's like, you know, I'm in a world of mythology, just being born in the family I was in, because they saw so much transition in technology during their lives, but they never looked inside themselves. So I had that kind of assignment given to me.
Well, Bardon, of course, has that very much of an emphasis on the five magical elements, which also figures in Theosophy and in the East, although they use wood, you know, and we do, their four elements are not exactly the same as ours, but they're very, you know, there's quite a bit of similarity in the idea of relating the elements, and of course we in Western magic, which Bardon has gone along with, is personifying the elements with their spirits, which you have really done a wonderful job, you know, making that come to life in your books. What I'd kind of like you, you know, to ask you is you studied Tibetan Buddhism, you studied Taoism, and you've actually practiced with these people, and Native Americans with the Hopis and would you say that all of this Eastern and Native American study and meditation experience, has that sort of dovetailed with what you found in Franz Bardon?
Well, it's kind of like you go to a master, and what you really want from them is that inner deepest inspiration which has illuminated their lives. So whatever that is, it's unique to the individual. So in a way, there's the tradition, the lineage,
yeah,
the,
yeah.
the system of training, but there's always something you get from that person. So in a way, the answer to your question is no. None of it has been very helpful to me other than to say, here's what we've done for 1,000 or 3,000 years, but hello, it doesn't work for you. And then I have to figure out what, I mean, I can get it to work for a year or two, but my body kicks in and says, no, you can't do that anymore. So like I practiced one of the, you know.
We have another guest interviewer too, and this is Merrick Hamer, Master Philos, who is he's our Golden Dawn premise trader. Brother Merrick, are you on?
I am here. I just tuned in. I wasn't listening before because I always thought that you couldn't hear the radio and talk on the phone at the same time. But so I realized
what was going on. I probably
missed whatever.
Don't get the phone too near the radio because you know then we get problems. You're right. And I want to mention that Bill. I want to mention that Merrick. is a librarian, and he's also a storyteller. And this is one of the reasons why I was very anxious to give him your book, because Merrick tells stories to children, and he's very, very good at this. He's almost like the Pied Piper of Los Angeles, you might say. So Merrick will be asking, some questions about the children's stories, one thing or another, and he's been reading your book. I still want to stay on this Bardonian theme because that's your main theme, and as we all know, the Hermetic tradition, the basic bedrock of the Hermetic tradition, is the four and the five elements, spirit being the animating element, or air, earth, fire, and water. And spirit, and they are, in European folklore and in magic, they are personified. We have the salamanders of the fire, and we have the sylphs of the air, and the undines of the water, the mermaids, and the gnomes of the earth. And of course, you can say the angels are sort of the spirit, the Akasha, and what have you. And the whole system of Western Hermetic magic is based on these elements. Now, also, so you personify them, and you can meet them inside in your chakras and you can meet personifications of them in person, which I noticed that in your first book, Undines, you met a number of personified mermaids, and that was fascinating. And yet, at the same time, Franz Barden, knowing that these creatures, and this, of course, dovetails with astrology, with the cardinal signs, Franz Barden, knowing that these elements were very strong in us, in our bodies, he had a balancing system, which he called mirrors, and you made these mirrors of your elemental makeup, and then he had quite a program for balancing them and balancing these elements because whatever you predominate, whatever elemental quality predominates in your personality, to be balanced, you need to balance all four elements. You want to talk about how you've handled that in your stories?
Well, I have a set of stories called Farmer Jack Allen and the Sylph, basically saying, you know, in the ordinary world, very magical, supernatural things happen, and here's a story about something that, you know, seems impossible, but actually you can run into these women or men who. If you interview them, over years, they look human, they talk human, but when you ask them a question, it's like you're talking to a being from another evolution. They are simply not human. They don't have a human soul. So it's been, I feel like the Brothers Grimm here. You know, I've been going around collecting stories, and some of these women, it takes me years to get them to reveal themselves to me. And then on the internet, women will put in, you know, they'll put in mermaid woman, and they'll do a search on Google, and they'll get my essay, Traits of Mermaid Women. And then they'll write me and say, you know, you're the only one that ever understands me. It's like you're inside my head. So that type of essay comes out of interviewing these people and asking them about their lives and how the world works for them and what they experience differently from other human beings. The main lesson I've learned after 5 years of my Find a Mermaid and Interviewer project is that the different elemental beings, the gnome, the fire spirit, the sylph, the air spirit, and the mermaid, when they're in a human body, they don't necessarily get along or connect to their other elemental beings. It's like I have a rule, don't mix realms. Some people are never supposed to talk to each other or interact with each other because their auras short each other out. Now, it can be very benevolent. Like I was in Oak Creek down in Sedona, and another girl who's like a mermaid and I were trying to show a gnome woman. We had her floating in the creek, and there was a mermaid down the stream, you know, an astral being. And we were trying to get her into the water element, and she just couldn't get it. She loves water, but she could not become water. And that's the nature of these you know, versus a someone with a great affinity to water, like a human who's incredibly empathic, but they still have an ego. The actual mermaids have no ego. If they relax, they become water itself. There's no fish or anything else attached to them in their consciousness. And they don't necessarily connect to the air spirits, and it's like they can't even comprehend the earth element. It's like the idea of a work ethic has no meaning to most mermaids, or the idea of exerting your will and committing to some project. It's meaningless because they're from a realm that's pure love. There's no survival going on there. They don't make things in the mermaid realm. So, you know, it's kind of shocking to me when I'm under orders from Barden to balance all five elements of myself, and I meet people with a soul that, you know, the other elements are simply incomprehensible to them. Some have more than one element, but in that case, they've got a complex thing going on, a struggle inside themselves to balance even two. So I'm just astonished and so appreciative of Barden that he says, you know, hey, work at it, get it. There's no excuse for failure. That's a wonderful thing for someone to say for me.
Yeah, this indicates, of course, and confirms that hermetic practice and hermetic meditation is a sort of a classical system of in a way of psychology, and of course that goes along with Jung, because Jung was quite enamored of it, and alchemy, and of course and astrology and alchemy, as we know, is very much centered in this whole elemental process. Now, going down your table of contents here, I'm looking at a story called The Carrier Strike Group Commander and the Mermaid, which I thought was really, really interesting. Did you ever spend any time on an aircraft carrier?
I almost spent a week on one, but my boss took the job instead of me. She thought she would go. She preferred to. She assigned herself rather than the next person in line. So I missed that opportunity. But I have taught Navy, Marines, and sailors in as a civilian instructor. I'm kind of used to, you know, how they think and stuff.
Yeah, but you certainly are a sailor, and I recognize that, being a sailor myself. The carrier strike group commander, they're sailing out in this little sailboat, away from the carrier and encountering the mermaid. This is a delightful story.
I'm glad you like it.
Being a former military man and not Navy and Army, but still, you know, and a sailor, I really appreciated that story, because there's one of the things I so much enjoy about this this collection of fiction of yours is the fact that it does not depend on conflict, on violence, as I said in the abstract to begin with. Most supernatural fiction is of the horror genre and what have you, or either that it's wildly fantastic and violent. And your fiction is entirely positive. Whatever conflict there is, it is presented in a very positive way. And in fact, you even have a story in here where the little girl, the mother, is trying to tell her a bedtime story and asks her what kind of a story she wants, and she says she wants a story with a lot of plot and conflict and all this kind of stuff. And that, of course, is not what she gets, but the story works out very well anyway. I don't want to give the impression that the book is, that derogatory term used so much for theosophical stuff called fluffy bunny. You know, this is not a fluffy bunny book, and you are not a fluffy bunny writer. And this is powerful, powerful, magical writing, and powerful magical characters drawn, but in a very, very positive way. Did you purposely plan to do that, or did you consider writing some kind of blood and thunder stuff, or did you purposely hold yourself back? Talk about that.
You got to look at what I'm dealing with, like the discussions about Atlantis. Here's a continent a whole civilization, and according to the myth, they screwed up. They lost their whole continent. So it's kind of like over and over, my stories are trying to get at that. Why? What could they have done different to prevent Atlantis from not being destroyed? So, you know, I've got stories here where the head of the Dark Order in Atlantis is talking to an archdemon. And the demon's saying, you know, hey, we do good work. You know, I want you to come work for me. You've got talent. So the underlying that is the fact that this guy does stuff that destroys the whole continent. But I'm not going into destruction as much as, you know, what set it up? What could they, you know, and the choices, what could they have done? Like the little kid says, I don't like the ending to that story. Give me a different ending. And these are people who deal with parallel realities, parallel worlds. They say, well, in this other world over here, just like Earth, it went a different way. I'll tell you that story if you want a different ending. In a way, it's like, you know, I could go into the violence, but in a way I'm trying to say that whole realm of violence is in question. You know, do you want that, or do you want to try to figure out how to come up with a different thing? Here we have North Korea, which in a half hour will kill 8 million people if they decide to nuke Seoul or something. So, you know, we're in a dark world here. Already, you know, you don't need me to say it's a dark world. It's right there.
Amen to that. I thoroughly agree with you. I mean, this is why this book is so inspiring and so delightful to read, especially with all the stuff that's going on now. It's almost therapeutic. You know, I put myself to sleep with it, for about a week, and it was. Actually, and then I take some mugwort and have some very beautiful dreams, and I want to thank you for that. It's really nice.
This carrier strikes the tender, and the mermaid. You see, that's kind of a sad story because this commander knows what it is to be a human being. He knows how the world works, and he's got this creature who is pure love. But he knows right away that he cannot have a relationship with her, even though she can take the body of a woman who's committing suicide, revive the girl, and spend a life with the commander. He knows. The problem is these mermaids don't know what they have no commitment. They don't know how to be there for you. They're so in the moment that if they're not with you, they're not even thinking about you. But if they're with you, you're getting more than you'd get from any other person. And he realizes, I need loyalty as a human being, and I can never get that from a mermaid. So it's kind of like he sees the conflict between two different worlds, and at some point in the future, in some other situation, they work it out. The guy will figure out, okay, the mermaid will say, yes, I'm loyal, I'm committed to you. And the guy will say, I have become part of your world. That way we are of the same species. But that's I can't find men who, you know, I've got these beautiful women who occasionally become free, but, you know, how can you recommend them to a man when they're dangerous to be around? They give you kind of, it's like being on cocaine, and you get the withdrawal symptoms, and the guys don't know how to handle that. There is a kind of dark, tragic theme being played out. You know, when I talk to these mermaid women now, one of my questions is, have any of your boyfriends committed suicide? Because that's come up a number of times. The guy,
yeah, of course, you're
it.
Taking a different approach than the Comte de Gabalais, who actually, you know, that 16th century novel in which he had his protagonists marrying these elementals on the astral and having relationships. This is kind of like Sukubi, you know, sort of like Sukubi and Incubi, you're taking this into our dimension and dealing with it in our dimension. And I think that that's perhaps, I feel that that's a more profound way to do it, because I agree with you. There are numerous elemental, personifications. In fact, you know, I said one time about conjuring to visible appearance when somebody asked me about it. And I said, okay, this is what's going to happen. Either it's going to show up in the dark mirror, it's going to show up in your dreams, or it's going to walk in your front door.
Right.
Absolutely. Master Philos, would you like to make some ask some questions of Bill?
Oh, sure. Well, thank you. First of all, I want to make sure I'm pronouncing it correctly. Is it William Mistele?
Mistele.
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 Ah,
yeah.
Excellent. Well, it's good to meet you.
It means little mistletoe in Swiss German.
Okay, Miss Mistele. Okay, very good. It's good to meet you over the phone.
Yeah.
And it's good to meet you through two of your books that I have here. One, of course, we've been talking about the stories of magic and enchantment. And then I believe anterior to that, you wrote one called Mermaids, Sylphs, Gnomes, and Salamanders. Have I got them in the right order?
And the first one was Undines.
And Undines. Yeah, the one I have is, it refers to them as mermaids. So I is that a different edition?
I don't know. If you go to Amazon.com, punch in Undines, and you get the book.
Okay, great. Well, anyway, I've been hearing some interesting things, including the Comte de Gabalais. I believe that in his situation, the destiny of these elementals was to obtain a soul, and they would try to connect with human beings for the purpose of giving them a soul. And I seem to recall that the character of Noah or Noah in the Bible was the result of commerce between. Between, I believe it was Zarathustra and a salamander. So that's fascinating stuff. Now, I am particularly interested in your stories. First of all, I have to mention that my mother is very much into fantasy, and she writes myths and things about fairies and gnomes. So I immediately identify with your work because it connects me with my mother as well. And she is in the process of finalizing some stories. One thing that you mentioned in I guess it's in the first book, there's one title called Gnome Mentilfe, is that correct?
Say it again.
The Gnome Mentifel.
Okay, the Gnome, go on.
Maybe I'm mispronouncing that, but... Anyway, I can identify with the idea that my mother one time communicated with a tree, and you know, my mother's has a lot of imagination, but she also has her practical side. And just one day she was going on for a good 30 minutes about how she had kind of filled at one with this tree, and that her soul had somehow merged in with the tree. And as I was reading your description of Mentifel the gnome, it just mustered up that memory.
Right. Yeah,
really
I do
intrigued
that.
Me. Yeah. So I presume you do a lot of meditating out in the wilderness, and perhaps even under the trees and amid the rocks and so.
I was 10 years in Tucson, and I had a habit of going out among the swirl cactus, where, you know, miles without no one around me. And I would sours, you know, I'd get up occasionally, but I would just pick one sephiroth from the tree of life and contemplate it for 6 hours. So that was that was me, you know. But I was in nature. You know, I had to do it in nature for some reason.
Nature and very much secluded, I presume.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Poke, thank you for mentioning the Pied Piper of Hameln, or Hamelin, as Robert Browning put it. That was actually my first production for children, was to enact the story of the Pied Piper, or as the Germans say, the Rattenfänger von Hameln. And it's interesting that in your discussion, I believe in regard to the story of Atlantis, Mr. Mistila was referring to changing the story. It had a bad ending, and we can change it to a good ending. And I recognize that with the production of the Pied Piper of Hameln, which can have, and perhaps traditionally it had, a very sinister conclusion. You know, first the rats went into the river Weser, and by insinuation, eventually the children were led into the river to be drowned. But there are several retellings of that story that place the children in a new and secret land where they could then build their utopia. And the story had a very optimistic ending. And so I appreciate the fact that what seems to be dismal can have an optimistic transition. And I agree with Poke that, you know, I get a positive message in whatever portions of your book I've read. I haven't read every one thoroughly. I'm probably about 50% through them. But I have sensed a very optimistic message. And that sits with me very well. Particularly, I look
this
at the
this is the wonderful what. Yeah. Merrick, this is the wonderful thing about this book is that it is its optimism and its positive qualities, as opposed to so much in what we call the occult and magic and you know is so dark and so and so conflicted, and so this
by which
this
we've been flooded
of,
and under which we've been inundated, right?
Right. And so this book is a breath of fresh air. It really is.
It is. It's very refreshing.
Now,
so in the I just wanted to mention about the idea of mermaids acquiring souls. You know, the ones I talked to is kind of like, are you kidding? The human race may not even be around very long. Why would I want to acquire a human soul? But and
well,
that's
I
the,
guess that
the girls
yeah,
talk
I guess that was. Yeah.
But in the second book, it's called Caius Aurelius Lucas and the Mermaid. A Roman senator goes to the temple of Jupiter, and he's told that he's got a woman who's a mermaid. And he's told point blank, you know, you can have a great relationship with her, but once she dies, she goes back to her own realm, and she's lost forever from the human race. So if you want to keep her around, to meet her again in another lifetime, or to make her a treasure that helps human evolution, you've got to give her a human soul. And so the story evolves into how to do that. In the first book, there's a story called The Modern Mermaid, where an Atlantean magician realizes, and this is verbatim from the girl, I got this on videotape, he realizes that in order to hold her in a human body, he's got to bind her to the five elements and shut her out from contact with her own realm. And she's reincarnated, and she's met that. This is her story. She tells me she and the magician have met each other again, and now they're in love. And he recalls the Atlantean experience. she recalls it, they share the same memories. So I'm saying, you know, you got a great story, you got to write this in a novel.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
So in some cases, it's in the interest of human beings to get them to have a soul. I don't think it's necessarily their own inclination to do so, from my experience.
And if they're perhaps we have to clean up the people that have souls need to do a little house cleaning first. And if we're going to give them a soul, we have to give them one that's a little more purified than perhaps is prevalent right now.
I guess.
Well, I think, let me say this. I think that that the human soul is sort of partakes of all five elements. I really believe it does. And regardless of how one particular element might be personified in an elemental, but if we're going to really be cabalistically metaphoric in all of this, and I'm not saying Barden would agree with me on this, but I think the human soul is our elemental pentagram, and in partakes of all four. Of all four of these elements, and I think this is why our mentor Franz Barden has us doing this balancing act with his internal mirrors. He wants us to get our soul he wants us to get our house in order, our spiritual house in order in this respect. Bill, I want either you or myself to read one of your shorter stories here to give the listeners an idea of just exactly what they're going to encounter in this book. And I have picked one out myself, which I'm sitting here looking at, that I would like. If you would rather me read it, I'll read it. Or if you would rather read it, then you have the book right there with you, I'm sure, then you could read it. But the story that I'd like to read is the Bedtime Stories 2, The Song of the Universe, which is on page 211. Would you rather read it, or would you rather have me read it?
No, I'd love to hear your voice.
What?
Go ahead.
All right. Daughter, mommy, mother, yes, dear, a daughter says, the bedtime stories you read me are sometimes scary. And the mother says, yes. And the daughter says, and that is because they are meant to prepare me for difficult things that I may encounter later in life. And the mother says, you could say that. And the daughter replies, but some things like hungry ghosts or maybe hobgoblins or monsters that lurk in closets when the lights go out, some things scare these creatures as well. And mother says, like what? And the daughter says, well, like a darkness that is darker than dark. Monsters are afraid of what they cannot understand and cannot in any way control. And the mother says, I'm sure that's true. And the daughter says, and some things are so bright, brighter than the brightest light. The stars were created to share their light. And the mother says, tell me more. And the daughter says, well, you read me a bedtime story every night, and then I fall asleep. And we have been doing this for years. Does anyone read you bedtime stories to help you fall asleep? And the mother says, bedtime stories for grown-ups? Why, yes. Each night before I go to sleep, I sit and meditate. And then I open my mind. But it is not a story that comes to me. There are no villains, no heroes, no quests, no maidens kidnapped by dragons who need to be rescued, no kingdoms to be saved from invasion, no mighty knights on white horses galloping across the land to right wrongs and to establish justice on earth, and no treasures to be found. And then the daughter says, no, what then? And mother says, instead, the universe sings to me. And when I hear her song, I fall asleep in peace. Just like you, after I have read you a story. And the daughter says, well, what is this song? And the mother replies, she sings of stars and galaxies. Each star is a note in her song, sounding on and on, sometimes for billions of years. And each galaxy is filled with wonders so magnificent, you have to experience them before you can imagine them. And she sings of the beginning of all things of innocence and purity. And as she sings ages, aeons, and kalpas of time pass before my eyes. And she sings, and I enter the minds of beings from all the realms, races, of which no man has ever seen or imagined. I enter their dreams and experience their lives, and they treat me as if I am one of them. Time is a stream, and this stream flows through me. And when she sings, I look and see the universe inside of me. She is my lover and my friend. And the daughter says, Mommy. And the mother says, Yes, honey. And the daughter says, Can you sing me her song? And the mother says, You want to hear the song of the universe? And the daughter says, Yes, I do. The song she sings to you before you fall asleep at night. And the mother says, Tomorrow night, if the sky is clear, we will sit outside and look at the stars. Pick any star you see, and I will tell you its song, its story, and the magic that it has to share. And when we have done this enough, you will begin to hear with my ears and see with my eyes. And then in every person you meet, you will sense hidden in them something of the joy of the universe that it wishes to share. And as you sense already, her light is brighter than bright, and the stars have been created so that we can see a small part of her beauty. And the daughter says, Good night, Mommy. And mother says, Good night, sweetheart. I think that's beautiful.
I really hope I did some justice to it,
but you know, it's the music of the spheres. Thank Pythagoras, the music of the spheres, and we end with the idea that of Namaste, the God within me salutes the God within you. I mean, who could ask for more than that? Beautiful. Bill, do you have a website that our listeners can go to explore more of your, do you?
For me?
Yeah, do you have a website that you can refer our listeners to?
Well, I every day I usually post on Facebook, facebook.com/WilliamRMistley. And there's also williammistley.com and williamrmistley.com. So you can get most of what I do right there. I must have five or six books on my Facebook page.
Yeah, that's what we need. I'm not much of a Facebook person, but so excuse me. I should have added to my website question. Is there any other story in the book here that you'd like to refer us to that we could either read or summarize?
Well, a lot of people like Farmer Jack Allen and the Sylph just because it's so ordinary reality, down to earth. I would say that seems to be a favorite all around. Just, it's a Barden idea. You know, the guy has an empty mind. He was kind of born with it. He can sit on his porch for a half hour and not think one thought. He notices things.
Oh, yes.
He feels, but he doesn't think. He doesn't comment or respond to anything he's perceiving. But his mind is.
Oh, yes. I recall that. That's very good. What page is that on right now? If you're on it,
right. It's Farmer Jack 7 and 11, and he meets these sylphs. Now the thing about sylphs, mermaids are highly
well, they're the ones that come in with the storm, I believe.
Some are very stormy. one girl, she broke up with her boyfriend. She sat on the beach in Santa Barbara. That night she had a talk with the sea, and it was so rough the next day the harbor was closed for 10 days. So you gotta be careful who you upset. But the Sylph girls are more uninhibited because they're of the air of freedom. So men tend to get more roused around. They don't know why. They're just in the room, and you know, these guys get turned on. They don't know where it's coming from. So that's a Sylph girl. You get this sense, marvelous sense of freedom and being relaxed beyond anything you've ever experienced before. So the farmer just has that thing that they get attracted to him because his mind is like the sky, and they like that. They really like that in human beings. So if you're around a Sylph, you know, because usually they're so busy sensing the weather, temperature changes, and pressure and humidity. and electromagnetism and evaporation, kind of, that they don't ever become still. But the sky is always behind all the weather. So when they meet a human being whose mind is like the sky, it's like, whoa, that is attractive. So that's how the story goes. He attracts two different girls who actually come down and live with him for a year.
Yeah. You, like myself, you went back to school and got a degree in anthropology, specializing in linguistics. And this, of course, shows in some of the stories here. I especially like when the one where God sends Michael, or sends the Archangel Michael down to kind of interview the Neanderthals, and then sends him down for the Cro-Magnons and what have you. And this is fascinating. But also, you keep going, and in the science fiction end of it, you're dealing with artificial intelligence, you know, with androids and how they feel and all that. And that, by the way, is very thought provoking and very profound. Because I think, as I recall, you have a story about an android that actually wants to. He kind of wants to be human and primarily wants to help human beings. Whereas so many of these science fiction stories, you know, they have the negative idea, like the androids are going to take over from us. And, you know, yeah, this is kind of a positive view of artificial intelligence. And, of course, you have the hierarchy of the universe and the Heavenly Dating Bureau, where people after, you know, very Swedenborgian, by the way. I'm sure you've read Swedenborg, you know, and also, I suspect that you've also read James Branch Campbell, because, you know, some of the I notice a touch of James Branch Campbell coming up at, around and about. Speaking of that, you give us kind of an idea of the magical fiction that has been an influence on you.
Well, these stories about the Akashic departments, that comes right from Bardon's 360 spirits of the Earth Stone. You know, like, must be at least eight of them that specialize in romantic love. So if you go to them, it's like they're sitting there in a room waiting, like, we're burned to tears. You know, no one ever visits us. And then it's like, oh, you want love. And they snap their finger, and you're madly in love with some girl you meet on the street or something, you know. But you've got to have wisdom to make it work. So the I had a friend, and he evoked the Venus spirit one time. He skipped the Earth Stone, he skipped the moon, he skipped Mercury, went to Venus, and the Venus spirit said, what can I do for you? And he says, what can you teach me? So he falls madly in love with this girl, and it's just, he can't handle it. So he calls the Venus spirit back and says, can you break this off, the spell? I can't live, you know, with this type of level of passion in my life. So that's kind of the drama that goes. You got the whole spiritual university here, and there's at least 12 spirits that specialize in writing stories and poetry. That's 3% of the Earth Stone is trying to get us to understand the power of a story. You want to understand yourself, write your life as a story. Then you know yourself. If you don't do that, you know, you're missing the drama of what it was to have lived your life. So, in a way, I'm cheating. You know, my parents, when they wanted me to study business and I wanted to study philosophy, I didn't get literature. So I'm kind of inventing this all out of thin air.
Your story about the troll under the bridge. I was thinking about your minor in accounting. When I was reading the story about the troll under the bridge, that was almost a projection there of Bill with his minor in accounting, and the troll under the bridge is a delightful story about the forgetful troll under the bridge that just can't handle the toll. He just can't handle collecting all these tolls. And finally, the wizard comes along.
What, that's Merrick? An important message on, I say that's an important message, that story on forgetting who we really are. And I seem to recall that the troll was consulting with the king of the trolls and said, well, no, don't abandon your post because three other trolls have turned into stone. And in a sense, I think by having our circumstances define us, we're really reducing the concept of who we are and developing dementia or whatever the condition was. And really it was a message at the end that said, you know, I can make you young again, and you can simply be as young as you really want to be.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
you're suddenly looking into
yeah.
yourself. That's a very
yeah,
important message, I think, especially for children. And I really admire that because of that, that moral message. Also, I found very interesting is you were talking, Polk, about conflict and the optimistic, the positive aspect of conflict. I identified that in the knight and the maiden and the dragon, where, you know, the king and the queen, I believe, they were going back and forth, one representing the dragon, one representing the knight, and they had this enormous conflict, their view of the world, and the only way it finally resolved was when each decided to step into the other's shoes and see what life was like, a knight to look at life, what life would be like as a dragon and vice versa. And that's how resolution came about. And I think that for children and adults is a very powerful message.
Yeah, that was fun. The dragon liked being a knight and having stories told about him.
Yes, yes. And, you know, frankly, Mr. Mistila, I believe that these stories of yours would really develop into beautiful little films if you ever wanted to consider that. And furthermore, the blue spruce tree, that one I can see being developed into a beautiful poem, potentially
yeah.
a poem.
That was fun.
Yeah.
It
was so gorgeous.
St. Patrick and the Elves had that conflict of Ireland, you know, like St. Patrick actually took a harp away from a bard because he said, you're playing notes that aren't Christian. So I kind of expanded that into how the queen of the blessed realm came into our world through the harp, and she took all the snakes of Ireland back with her, which was a tribute to St. Patrick.
Finally convinced St. Patrick that, you know, that everybody, every entity, whether Christian or not, has something to give to the world.
Yeah,
it's
that
a beautiful
that
story.
Was, it'll
beautiful
take
story.
Ages for them to work that out, though.
Absolutely.
Yep, you know, the stories of Atlantis were very good too, and I think you kind of follow Edgar Casey on the Atlantis thing with the crystal technology and also the creation of the variforms. And I think that all in all this entire book is just delightful and we can't recommend it. We can't recommend it too much. I mean, it really should be on every occultist and magician's bookshelf after they read it. And so I'm going to encourage people to get it. It is it's called Stories of Magic and Enchantment by William R. Mistele, and it's published by Falcon Books Publishing. And don't confuse that with Falcon Press. This is a new company, Falcon Books Publishing. And I want to thank you very, very much, Bill, for coming on with us. And of course, especially for sending us the copies of the book. And we wish you all the success possible with this one. And do I read things wrong when I'm looking at that Falcon's website? Do you have a book on magical Western magical tantra coming up?
No, she's got Martin Fox and Virgil and a number of people who she's publishing. It's really nice because Tanya's kind of forming a group out of us. We would never connect to each other, but she's bringing us all together, so that's really fun. I have a book on mermaid stories coming out next through Falcon, and also a screenplay and biography of a girl from the Pleiades, the mermaid, but she's also Starseed.
Are you going to publish the screenplay, or are you going to try to get it into production?
Well, first is the biography, and then I'm going to write the biography is basically done, and publish that, and then the screenplay comes out of that. That takes a little more. You have to create a mindset of screenplays, not novel, and then it's finding a producer.
So, in other words, it's going to be narrative treatment style for publication.
It's exactly like the movie K-Pax, about a guy who's from another star who ends up in a human body here. She's got a story just like that.
I love that K-Pax. That K-Pax is a beautiful story. Yeah.
I found the female version of the story.
Yeah.
And perhaps
anyway,
a documentary on life through the eyes of a gnome. I think that's when you'll have to come up with.
Through the eyes of a gnome. Or a troll from under the bridge. And I got the bridge. I got the bridge out here. The troll could stay under. Okay. Thank you so much, Mel. And we look forward to the next to your next book. And we want this one to go out to all the folks that will enjoy it. And thank you, Merrick, for coming on and contributing. And we'll see you guys
soon.
I thank you both.
Thanks. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Mestile, and thank you, Pope.
Thanks, Master Pylos, and thanks, Master Bill Mestile. And I certainly deserve the title. Both of you certainly deserve the title of maestro. And all the rest of you out there listening, tune in next week, same time, same channel. And meanwhile, good magic.
Good night.
Good night.